everybody on board. Council, good morning to you. This is the case of McCauley versus CL Enterprises, Inc. And we will start today by introductions from the court, and then we will acknowledge counsel on hearing, and then we will proceed with arguments. I am Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now by seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning, William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik, good morning.
And John Frydenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. And you will note that Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this matter. Now, counsel, Mr. Levitt, are you with us today?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. Mr. Salerno, are you with us today?
I am here on behalf of this office.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Mullen, are you with us?
Yes, Judge, I am present.
Good morning to you. Mr. Welch, are you here today?
Your Honor, this is Damian Wright, appearing on behalf of Welch Law Firm and Hardscapes Contractors.
Very good. Good morning to you. Mr. McDowell. Mr. Schartz.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm here.
Good morning to you. And Ms. Ryan, are you here?
You're on mute, Julie.
Ms. Ryan, you are muted.
Sorry about that, Your Honor. I am here.
Welcome to WebEx. Good morning to you. And Mr. Matukowicz, are you with us today?
Good morning, Your Honor. Yes, I'm here.
Good morning to you, and I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Perfectly, thank you.
Do any counsel have questions before we begin? I am hearing no questions. Now, I understand Appalese, Mr. Levitt, you are going to take, are you going to take 7 minutes? Is that your?
Approximately 6 to 8 minutes, yes, Your Honor.
6 to 8 minutes. You will be responsible for that. The bailiff will not be stopping the clock somewhere 6 to 8 minutes. And then, which other counsel are going to be arguing on the side of the Appalese?
Your Honor, this is Rob Schartz. We sort of decided that we would open ourselves up for individual questions at that point in time from the court, because generally speaking, the issues are pretty aligned.
So none of you will be actually making a presentation. You'll be available for questions?
Well, Your Honor, I guess we're all going to try to squeeze in our own little 2 cents. I mean, I plan on doing that for approximately a minute, just to respond to Mr. Matukowicz.
So that's what I need to know. Which of you are going to?
I will, Your Honor. I'll speak for 1 minute.
Very good. Who else?
Your Honor, this is Bob Mullen, and on behalf of Able, I do not intend to talk unless the court has any questions for me related to claims against my client.
Very good. Who else is going to?
Your Honor, this is Damian Wright. I do not intend to speak unless the court would have any questions related specifically to hardscapes.
Very good. Ms. Ryan, how about you?
Your Honor, I will also not be speaking. I am from the same office as Mr. Schartz.
Very good. So as I understand it, Mr. Levitt, you are going to take 7 to 8 minutes, and Mr. Schartz, you are going to then take the remainder of that time.
Got it.
I believe that's true.
Yeah, I'll take a minute just to respond. I mean, I don't know how much Mr. Levitt will leave me, but that's fine.
Very good. Any further questions from any of the council arguing today? Mr. Matukiewicz, then you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge Hevekin. May it please the court, my name is Michael Matukiewicz, and I represent the appellants in this case, Richard McCauley individually, and on behalf of his late wife, Michelle McCauley. Now, this is a construction defect case arising from improper workmanship. The McCauleys own the property located at 8707 North 96th Street in Omaha, and they purchased that property while they were living in Virginia. During approximately 2006, May of 2006, the McCauleys began working with Aslan Custom Homes to begin constructing a home on the property here in Douglas County. During the course of construction, Aslan actually ceased its operations during about September of 2007. Now, the home proceeded forward through construction with the assistance of the McCauleys from Virginia, and the McCauleys actually moved into the home during late February, early March 2008. So it was about a 2-year construction project. After they moved in, the McCauleys began discovering improper workmanship and defects in construction and attempted to work with 11 individual contractors to no avail ultimately. So on February 7th, 2012, the McCauleys filed suit in the Douglas County District Court against 11 contractors, basically again alleging improper workmanship and defective construction. After a series of orders beginning on March 24th, 2014, and ending in an order on January 6th, 2020, all of the claims were either settled, there were some settlements, and other defendants were dismissed on summary judgment. So this is a summary judgment case, and it is noteworthy that in reviewing a summary judgment, the appellant court views the evidence in the light most favorable to the party against whom judgment was granted, here the McCauleys, and gives the McCauleys every benefit of the inferences deducible from the evidence. It's also noteworthy, ladies and gentlemen of the court, that as you know, summary judgment is such an extreme remedy and should be used sparingly because it may dispose of the litigation itself as it did with respect to these defendants and deny a trial to hear the McCauleys. Now, with respect to the review on the statute of limitations issue, that is a de novo review on the record. And with respect to the second aspect of this case, a denial of a motion to amend, that is an abuse of discretion standard. Now, in this case, the district court, we believe, erred in holding that the McCauleys' claims against 7 of these contractors to this appeal were time barred by section 25.223. And the operative language in 25-223, which is the statute regarding construction defects, provides that the action shall be commenced within 4 years after any alleged act or omission constituting such breach or deficiency occurred. Now here, the McCauleys relied upon that statute as well as the case law interpreting it. And two noteworthy cases, ladies and gentlemen of the court, are Witherspoon versus Sites Construction, which is a 1985 case. And in that case, the Nebraska Supreme Court held in construing 25-223 that the act giving rise to the cause of action occurred when the construction of the house was completed. Likewise, that decision was cited during the course of this case, actually, ladies and gentlemen, in 2015 in the Adams versus Manchester case. And there, this court elaborated further where the basis of the claim is improper workmanship resulting in defective construction, the statute of limitation runs from the date of substantial completion of the project, not the date of any specific act which resulted in the defect. Now, this court-
Counsel, in a case like this, where your clients acted as their own general contractor, how should we be viewing the project? If we focus in on what is the project, help me with how we describe that here.
That's a good question, Judge Stacy. And in this case, when you examine, what we have to go on is the statute and the cases construing the statute so far. And I'm not aware of any cases which specifically say we measure from each specific act of a subcontractor where an owner steps in the shoes of a general contractor. So again, there was nothing to rely upon But this court has given the substantial completion rule and gone further in the Luder case in 1998, where this court actually defined substantial completion. It said that substantial completion, is the date when construction is sufficiently complete for the owner to occupy or utilize the work, period, the house. And Judge Stacy, to further answer your question, in this case, we have one of the examples is Able Plumbing. Now, in that case, the plumber says that the plumbing groundwork, which is beneath the basement, most of it, was done well before completion of construction of the house. However, keep in mind here, the McCauleys live in Virginia during construction of the house. They had no way to know that the plumbing work, the groundwork, was insufficient. After moving in, they had a backup of raw sewage into their home, and they learned that upon digging up the basement that the plumbing actually sloped uphill instead of downhill, not allowing it to leave the house. So I believe it would be unrealistic and unfair to say that the McCauley's statute began to run with respect to Able Plumbing when there's groundwork laid upon which a basement is going to surface, which can't be used until the home is complete. Now, the home is a system of systems and different pieces that are kind of useless alone. The plumbing is useless until it's connected to the rest of the systems in the house. Similar to a heart cannot serve the body unless it's connected to the circulatory system. So we believe that there should be a clear and precise rule that all homeowners and all contractors should be able to rely upon if they have claims against a contractor, which is that when the home is complete and fit for its intended purpose, here substantial completion, that is when the statute of limitation begins to run. And in this case, again,
are you familiar with our somewhat recent decision in Fuel Berth versus Heartland Heating?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. The December 2020 decision, I have reviewed it.
Does that have any bearing on this case?
That, well, I'll be honest, in looking at that, the court went into, I believe, citing the restatement of torts and a lot of very historic pieces. They go into the divisible versus indivisible discussion throughout that case. And in this case, I would argue again that here we have an indivisible project that until all of the components are complete and put together, the house cannot be used for its intended purposes. And this is further supplanted by the City of Omaha ordinances, and most communities have them, which say that you can't or shouldn't occupy a home until the home is complete. Here, this didn't pass these inspections in November of 2007. The McCauleys ultimately moved here and moved into the house, but again, there was never a date of substantial completion prior to them moving in.
You characterize it as an indivisible project. I believe the discussion in Fuel Berth was about indivisible or divisible contracts.
Yes.
Didn't your clients have separate contracts with each of the contractors?
That would be fair to say, yes, Your Honor, most of them being verbal, but that is true. And again, at Fuel Berth,
and so wouldn't the statute of limitations be different for each contract then?
I think the Fuel Berth case is distinguishable because that had to do with an already completed farmhouse and farm property. I believe what the plaintiffs were doing there were constructing geothermal work, both in an outbuilding as well as in the house. And the court in that case was discussing the two projects of outside and inside. Here again, they had a completed project and were supplementing it. In this case, you don't have anything to work from until you have a completed home. So I think it's distinguishable based on existing versus new construction. I'm sorry.
If during the performance of the contract, you had noticed a problem, your clients had noticed a problem with the work of one of the contractors, could they bring suit immediately upon noticing that problem, or do they have to wait until the entire house is substantially complete?
I think with the existing guidelines set forth by the statute and cases construing them, the party should wait until after the house is completed and the house has been delivered to them. Even most general contracts provide that an owner can't occupy the house or go to the house for any extended period of time until the house has been completed, substantially completed, and delivered to the owner.
So again, if a contractor walks off the job, says they're done, your client doesn't believe it's done, you just have to wait until the house is complete before your claim accrues?
I think that's probably a separate claim for breach of contract rather, and I think a different statute would probably apply than 25-223. I think we'd be looking at a contract for breach of contract if a contractor walked off, rather than the defective workmanship statute 25-223. I see I'm about out of time. If there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve at least my 30 seconds.
I do have a question. Sorry to mess that up for you, counsel.
Stacy.
Your second assignment of error pertains to the denial of the oral motion for leave to file a fourth amended complaint. And as I understand the record, that motion was made during the pendency of summary judgment motions. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the reason for the timing, oh, go ahead.
I was curious to know what the allegations of the proposed fourth amended complaint were. And so I went to the record to look, and I wasn't able to find it anywhere. Did I overlook something, or was it not offered as an exhibit?
So this goes to the timing, Your Honor. The Adams.
My question is, where is it in the record? Where would I look in the record to see the allegations?
I believe it's exhibit 64. Exhibit 50, if we go to exhibit 50, it was offered on the motion to reconsider. And again, the timing of this was the Adams decision came down and was actually published the week before. I think it was on the Friday before this hearing, early in the week on November 2nd. So there's a very short time period between the Adams decision and a kind of a new interpretation in our view when we reviewed it. And we had the hearings already scheduled on the summary judgment. So at the hearing, we had put together very quickly a draft amended complaint. We did show it to other parties and to the court. We explained it to the court and did not actually offer it. We did offer it, however, on the motion for reconsideration, which I believe is in the exhibit 50 that I just cited.
Counsel, is that the same motion? Is that the same proposed fourth amended complaint that was shared previously, though? Because I note that the one you're referencing has a date of March 2016 on it. And so how are we to know whether it is the same pleading, if you will, same proposed pleading that the court considered in ruling on your motion, your oral motion?
Well, although it was presented to the court and it was not offered, so that I agree it was not offered. So the court probably did not actually review it. However, in reviewing the pleading statute 6-1115, there is not a requirement that the court or that a sample complaint that's proposed be submitted. And in fact, what the rule says is a denial of leave is appropriate only in those limited circumstances in which undue delay, bad faith on the part of the moving party, or futility of the amendment, or even unfair prejudice of the non-moving party can be demonstrated. And here at the hearing, the testimony from the record will show that the affidavits submitted in opposition to that motion for summary judgment did have allegations of breach of the warranty as necessary for the amendment. And that would have changed the statute of limitations as to affordable as beginning on March of 2009, and as to style in February of 2009. So again, to sum the answer, I don't believe it's required that you actually offer the draft complaint. It was later done, however, and made part of the record. But the bigger point being that the court found it being futile when, if you read the allegations in the affidavits, it was not futile. It created a triable issue of fact. And the court also on its
Counsel,
own-
Counsel, you've answered my question, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Stacy. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Levitt, good morning to you, and you may proceed. You are muted, Mr. Levitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, Danny Levitt on behalf of Dan Becker, DBA Dan Becker Construction. I will, as mentioned before, take about 6 to 7 minutes to address the statute of limitations assignment of error and defer any remaining time for questions for the other co-appellees. The issue on appeal here is whether the appellants acting as general contractors can bring their claims against subcontractors after the 4-year statute of limitations in 25-223, which is triggered by the subcontractor's separate projects. and not when they're not just substantially completed, but totally completed. And I'd like to make at least 2 points in this regard. The first point is the language of 25223, which states, quote, any alleged act or omission, close quote, on which a breach of deficiency rests, being unambiguous, and that the district court was correct when it found that this language clearly applied to the facts of this case to dismiss the McCauley's complaint. The second point would be that the allegations in a complaint have and continue to be the underpinnings of determining the statute of limitations issue in 25223. That is, what is the act or omission that is being alleged? In this instance, against Becker, it would be the breach of warranty and negligence. And the district court agreed with the appellees in its order and found that under the facts of this case, the appellants are time barred from pursuing their claims and appropriately dismissed the case. With regard to the first point, and in conjunction, I think, with Justice Papik's questions regarding the fuel berth case, that this case would be more aligned with a divisible contract as opposed to the indivisibility. And that is because on a 10,000 foot view, each project was done on a separate contract, and each project had its own subcontractor who was performing these. And especially in light of the McCauley's having the project performed with them serving as the general contractors, in that context, I think that this would align more with a divisible context as opposed to the indivisibility.
Counsel, your opponent seems to suggest that our Witherspoon case and the Adams case weigh in the opposite direction from where you are headed. Do you agree, and do you distinguish those cases from the present situation?
We distinguish those from the present situation, Justice Castle, and so because in the same rationale that the district court relied on in its order, on page 324 of its order in the transcript, distinguishing Witherspoon because those cases do not pertain to a general contractor alleging a breach of warranty or negligence against subcontractors on the one hand. On the other hand, I think they're distinguishable because none of the propositions in those cases cuts against Becker's position. In other words, the project was substantially complete in January 2007. Mr. Becker never returned to the site to perform any work. Billing was completed and he was paid by June of 2007. I think the same would hold true for Able, Timberland, and Hardscape, who completed their projects in 2007 as well. So I think from that standpoint, those cases do not cut against our position because our projects were substantially complete, not just substantially complete, but totally complete by 2007, which would trigger a statute of limitations in 2011, as opposed to later on when the McCauley's filed suit in 2012.
Mr. Matukiewicz, it seemed to me, also argues that city ordinances have something to do with this and that there is not completion for any of this until the city puts its imprimatur on the building. How do you respond to that?
Sure, a few responses, Your Honor. The first response would be, with respect to Mr. Becker, there was actually an inspection done, and the framing work was completed in accord with that framing inspection requirement in the first part of 2007. So with regard to him, any inspections were completed. And in further response, with regard to the city code, I don't think there's anything in the statute of 25223 that envisions a requirement that there be occupancy or that the owner can move in or any of those types of requirements. Those are clearly absent from the statute and the language of the statute, which would lead me to my second point, which is the district court appropriately relied upon looking to the allegations to determine this idea of substantial completion. First of all, the statute says alleged breach, alleged deficiency, and alleged act or omission. And the allegations from the McCauleys toward the Becker, Mr. Becker, was that he failed to properly install the interior and exterior windows and doors at the McCauleys' home. So looking at those specific allegations, as opposed to the project as a whole, for instance, in the Witherspoon case, the allegation was that the home failed to be completed under workmanlike manner. In this instance, the allegation was that Mr. Becker failed to construct the windows and the doors. It is much more specific. And that project was totally complete in January 2007. So in conclusion, Becker would urge the court to conclude that the district court was not clearly wrong when it refrained from broadening the scope and the depth of 25.223 and instead gave it its plain meaning and found that the McCauleys were time barred from pursuing their cause of action. And I would reserve the balance of my time for any of the co-appellees for any questions that the court may have for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schartz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Robert Schartz, and I represent Timberland Hardwood Floors in this matter. And I believe Judge Papik's line of questioning is directly on point here. These contracts are not all tied together. We're not dealing with a general contractor being sued who would have been responsible for the delivery of the entire house in arguably an occupiable fashion or condition. In fact, my client Timberland installed some floors, and that work was completed no later than November of 2007, which would have started the statute of limitations on that contract. Certainly Timberland was not responsible for delivering a whole house or any other product other than laying the wood flooring in this residence. There's no tolling issue with regards to the discovery. Any issues that the McCauleys raised in their complaint or amended complaints were visible to them well within the 4 years following that. So there's really no explanation with regards to the untimeliness of their filing. Nonetheless, we believe that the district court's decision was not clearly wrong. It was well reasoned, and there's been no case law, including December's case, which would take that away in terms of the reasoning of the court. So based on that, Your Honors, I would ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. So that concludes arguments in McCauley versus CL Enterprises, Inc. Counsel, thank you all for participating by WebEx this morning. And at this time, you are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Gunther versus Walnut Grove Hillside.